It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 543, and it's May the 2nd, 1982. I have been talking the last 3 weeks about the Falkland Islands and the Antarctica connections to Argentina and the importance of Antarctica to world affairs. This is an area that's been long ignored by persons in teaching geography, teaching history. It's up to us to find it for ourselves, but I have reason to believe that Antarctica is much more important than we were even directed to find. Oh, here, Matthew, are we on now?
You're on.
Should I start over?
No, you're okay.
Keep going?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we better start over just in case and say it's Mae Brussel, broadcast number 543, May the 2nd, 1982, just in case it didn't get on the tape. Regarding the Falkland Islands, the Argentine conflict with Great Britain, the last 3 weeks I've been going into Antarctica and the importance of Antarctica in terms of history, of what's down there, of what has been linking the possible Nazi connections, the UFO connections, the space stations, what is going on in Antarctica, and some articles in the New York Times and a few other articles, very few, have brought out the importance of Antarctica to the Falkland Islands and to Argentina. But this is an area that, as I just briefly said before, if we were on or off the air, I'm not sure at that time, we were never taught in geography classes what was going on in Antarctica. While there's a lot of literature out about the area, I have never really pursued it or looked for very much in the many articles that have been published, except that I do take a bulletin from the government on Antarctica development and do cut out articles from time to time. And this week I went into depth into three articles that were in the National Geographic that I outlined on this particular area to see what I had missed in the past, to go back and just look at some of the things that are happening down in there, because I do think it has a lot to do with controlling the entire area. What Argentina would have if they would get Great Britain out of the area, what they would be controlling in terms of not only oil and mineral and resources, but what else is going down there. Now, the March 1964 National Geographic had a section on Operation Deep Freeze that began in 1963. That was the year that John Kennedy was assassinated. That was quite a long time ago. And they used those controversial Lockheed C-130s to take large staffs of people down to Antarctica. The C-130s came into the news recently with regards to the Western Airline and Neil Burke and the delivery of C-130s, these huge transports to Gaddafi, that the government had stopped the shipment, that we had held them up in Atlanta, Georgia, and didn't want Gaddafi to have these huge planes. But what I didn't realize was that in 1963 and 1964, the United States had large C-130 transports that they were taking from Andrews Air Force Base, which is part of the space shuttle program, down to Cape Town in South Africa, and then down to Argentina. And that there were stations in Antarctica, 5 run by Great Britain at the time, 4 by Chile, and 3 by Argentina, and that these airplanes could fly 4,700 miles from Cape Town, South Africa, and they could carry 3,600 gallons of 3,600 gallons of gasoline, or 145,000 pounds of fuel for each plane, that the process for delivering large amounts of equipment was possible as far back as 1963, that Lockheed C-130s, those huge transport planes, and that they used them, according to the National Geographic, to take a lot of equipment down to Antarctica and also to study the stresses of hostile environment for possible use in space, which I read later in the New York Times just several weeks ago, the importance of Antarctica in terms of space laws, or how to manage space colonies, the laws that apply to Antarctica or to space colonies or colonies on the moon. But this goes way back. The development began a long time ago, and the technology for moving large amount of people and equipment began. And this one National Geographic article says that Antarctica will serve as a way station between South Africa and Australia. It was serving, this was early in 1963, and in 1962 we had begun to send the huge transports. And one of the first people to go down there with this operation of the C-130s was Lowell Thomas, who was a famous newscaster who was strongly identified and linked with the CIA. Another article I read about Antarctica that was even more interesting, the National Geographic, October 1968, was just a mind-boggler. And the title of that article that I had is Antarctica, the Icy Testing Ground for Space. And I looked at the issue, which I never was aware of before, of who was on the board of trustees of the National Geographic, because this particular article had such shocking information in it in terms of what is happening in other places around the world today. And on the board of directors was Lawrence Rockefeller, Juan Tripp, that's T-R-I-P-P-E, who was chairman of Pan American World Airways, and that's the airline that was trying to get monopoly of all the routes to South America and down to this area. And they fly Navy planes down to Antarctica. This was in the National Geographic article. Their Pan Ams are available for the Navy to fly down there also. This last week, Eastern Airlines was given the route that Braniff had to stop the monopoly of Pan Am throughout entire South America. But Mr. Tripp was honorary chairman of the board of Pan Am World Airways, was part of National Geographic Society. And Earl Warren, the great Chief Justice of the United States in 1968. Now, Earl Warren headed the commission to investigate the murder of John Kennedy. And there were Nazis involved in Argentina that he covered up in his investigation purposely. He had information that he could have pursued down to Argentina of the links to Lee and Marina Oswald, and to Lee Oswald in the Dallas-Fort Worth area with Walter Dornberger and the space program, the Wernher von Braun and the Nazis that were linked to Bell Helicopter Aerospace in Texas. Earl Warren had covered up the Nazi connections of those persons down in Argentina and in this area, including Wernher von Braun, who would travel down to Antarctica. He was a visitor down to see these space stations that he called future moon stations. Earl Warren was on the board of the National Geographic, and also Curtis LeMay, former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force, and Mr. William Martin, Jr., chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. There was quite an interesting group, and James Webb of NASA, the administrator for NASA, and NASA, Wernher von Braun, and Walter Dornberger were named in the Torbit document and in other information as one part of the five-prong group that were involved in the killing of John Kennedy. And the Rockefellers had given money and identification to George de Morenschild when he was suspected of being a Nazi war criminal. He was Lee Harvey Oswald's close associate. So on the board of National Geographic, with the activities going down in Antarctica, a lot of activity, there was Lawrence Rockefeller and Mr. Tripp from Pan Am, Earl Warren, James Webb from NASA, and Curtis LeMay, and the head of the Federal Reserve System. Now, this one article says that over the past 75 years of National Geographic, and this was dated 1968, up to 1968, they had more than 70 articles on Antarctica, and I was never aware myself that there was such a large amount of information accumulated about this particular area and what was going on. And they said that men now live and work at the South Pole. They have for dozens of years, and there's at least 40 scientific outposts. Now, this was in 1968, that there were four stations there and outposts going on all the time down at the South Pole. This article also said that they had a nuclear power station in Antarctica. And I mentioned several weeks ago the possibility and references of the man-made UFOs coming out of the Antarctic area in the South Pole linked to the Argentine military regime and the Nazis in South America. This one National Geographic in 1968 said they had a nuclear power station. They had a nickname for it called, well, it's so ridiculous. It was called Nuki Poo. Okay, that's their nuclear power station, that they generate electricity from atomic heat, and they distill fresh water from the sea for a settlement of 1,000 men in the summer and 200 during the fierce winter at this one station. Now, National Geographic, with a long list of scientists on the board, in addition to these other people, is saying that they distill fresh water from the sea. And I'm wondering about droughts in Biafra or Nigeria, Liberia, Kenya, Ethiopia, with masses of starving people, huge masses of humanity that you've seen on television, on World Vision, and I've done programs on this before, being allowed to die because the area is dried up, there's drought, there's no food, and large groups of Christian organizations coming in and teaching them that if they turn to Christianity, God will save them. And huge masses of people, 10 to 20 million, dying every year from drought and lack of water. And how is it possible that they are desalting water for people living down in Antarctica? Either I'm not reading this correctly, or there's something going on that most of us are not aware of. And I really believe that that is the truth, because I know during, at the end of World War II, the Germans had sulfa medicines and prescriptions that the United States didn't get for a long history of years. And there's certain countries that have cures for conditions and health situations that this country doesn't have, and we prolong illnesses where other cures are available in other places. Now, if there is atomic energy down there, and if there is fresh water from the desalting, then the droughts and the genocide that's going on of the large masses of population has to be purposeful, because if you can provide the technology from the tip of the ocean down at the South Pole, you could be doing the same thing around Africa or Central America or wherever there's droughts. So this one particular issue in 1968, October 68, talks about desalting water, and that's how they live down there. This article also talks about biologists from the Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech and how they study psychology and how men would live under stress and cramped into isolated spaces for future space stations and colonies up in space and moon colonies. Well, the people like Jacques Vallée have said that the UFOs are man-made, and the sightings predominantly are coming out of the Antarctic area. And it seems that there is this tremendous technology that many of us might have overlooked. If you can believe National Geographic and their sources, and again, this 1968 issue has a picture of those huge airplanes, the C-130 Hercules, coming in and supplying laboratories. And it says they built large roads and this construction work, and it goes into the use of bringing in equipment to Antarctica and the South Pole by the Lockheed C-130s. And there evidently is a lot more building than we know is going on, and it describes the building and the road construction and the housing and the open water that's available, and there's a picture of dry areas similar to the Mesa in Arizona that many of us don't associate with the South Pole. This same article says the Navy chartered Pan American Airlines down there as early as 1957 down to Antarctica. Remember, there was a disproportionate amount of bodies at Jonestown. It jumped from 420 or so up to 912. And I believe that they were being experimented upon in Venezuela or other areas in South America and were then flown in. They decayed at a different rate. And with these huge transports and with the intent to study people under stress, and psychologists and scientists working on sleep behavior, dreaming, cramped behaviors, isolated conditions, future space stations. October 1968 of this National Geographic goes into, shows pictures of people being experimented, adults evidently, they're giving permission. But goodness knows what else you can do in an area the size of the United States and Mexico combined. We can't even keep track of what's going on in places like Vacaville, much less what's down at Antarctica or, say, the homes that Jim Jones had in this country. And that same issue shows an area in Antarctica. It says one of the strangest regions in Antarctica is the Scott Coast. Behind that area, there's the towering Royal Society Range. There's valleys that are ice-free, desert-like, like the Mesa Lands of the American Southwest. And it goes in, again, I described brown hills and clear water. It's at Wright Valley and several others like it, slope inland rather than to the sea. And there's the Onyx River, a stream that bubbles and it seems to go up head towards a Lake Vonda. And they tell about drinking water, icy water from the lake, and having a hot tub and refreshing themselves on a desert in Antarctica that doesn't have snow or ice at all. So that you get a different view when you read some of the back issues, which I started to do, of Antarctica. I don't have all 70 that they published up to 1968, but a few of them. And in terms of chronology, by 1968, according to this issue, travel to Antarctica is almost routine travel, like going to any distant land. In 1968, they started Operation Deep Freeze, which was supposed to be scientific research. In 1968, the C-130s had airlifts of scientists and the huge Hercules airplanes, and they made daily flights around areas visiting different stations. And the same article refers to diesel bulldozers, huge tractors, trailer trucks, graded roads, cargo ships with icebreakers that came and went, and that they had, as I say, the use of nuclear power down there since 1963, and that they wanted to make a prototype for living future on the moon, and that in January 68, Wernher von Braun was there. He was there lots of times, but this just mentions one particular time, as well as biologists and physicists and psychologists studying people's reactions to living under these cramped conditions. So this has been a place of building. I knew that there was a lot of money going down constantly. I mentioned that on the program before. There's a lot of building, something that we can't even visualize how much there is. And it could be that Jacques Vallée's interpretation of where those UFOs came from could indeed come down from the same place as the atomic energy that could fuel those very UFOs that he says are man-made, that are seen all around the world, but particularly down that area. Another National Geographic article in 1976, of June 76, tells about the National Foundation going down there in Antarctica in 1966. And it gives a little history of Admiral Byrd and his first exploration. And I talked several weeks ago on the secrecy of Admiral Byrd's papers of what he saw in 1946 and 47 that are locked up. But he went down there in 1933. This says Richard Byrd spent time down there in expedition. He was appointed honorary postmaster of Little America in 1928 to 1930. The National Geographic Society encouraged and helped finance Admiral Byrd to go down for his second expedition from 1933 to 1935. So 1928 to 1930, he was encouraged to go down to the South Pole. In 1933 to 35 was the next expedition. So when the National Geographic published a map in 1957 and again 1963 of an area that Hitler was anxious to have a German foothold in 1939, that doesn't sound so bizarre. Why wouldn't Adolf Hitler stake out a place from 1938 to 39 if Admiral Byrd is down there from 1933 to 35? The Americans were down there, the American military were down there, the scientists were there. So the Germans certainly kept up and were more advanced than us on many of the technologies for surviving down there, I'm sure. And they had the rockets and missiles that we brought to this country as soon as World War II was over, and brought the scientists, as many as we could, to the United States and to the space program. So Antarctic area, the South Pole, was not unknown to the Germans any more than Admiral Byrd, and it wasn't an isolated thing that they staked out this area and began to develop it with all the equipment and huge planes, which seems they've been doing all along. And as I said before, I think the interesting thing is how early the atomic energy was down there. We can't seem to get atomic energy going in this country at all. And our plants, like the Three Mile Island or down at San Luis Obispo or 30 other plants, have been temporarily shelved or they're not working. What techniques do they have down there that have worked continuously? We haven't read about any leaks or any problems. And what way do they support themselves with water? Are they desalting themselves the water and drinking out of the same ocean that all of us assume can't be desalted yet? Maybe they have a technique they've used for 20 or 30 years that has not been shared with the rest of the world, which would be a good tool, a weapon, being able to sustain their own water system. Obviously, that's being done down there and nowhere else, it seems, in the world, or at least we're not told about it. Another friend sent me an article from National Geographic, April 1962, and it showed John Connally with Admiral Byrd. Connally was Secretary of the Navy, and he was active with the astronauts, of course. And on the stand, there's a picture of them. Old comrades here, John Connally Jr., then Secretary of the Navy, praised Byrd's determination and sheer grit for going down to Antarctica. Well, John Connally worked, if you've read the Torbett document, worked with an organization called Permandex that worked with NASA and Wernher von Braun, who was frequently down in Antarctica, and Walter Dornberger from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Dornberger lived in Texas when John Connally left the Navy and became the governor of Texas. And they were both involved in the planning and the cover-up, at least the cover-up, of the murder of John Kennedy, and I believe Dornberger had an even more insidious role, he and Wernher von Braun, in that particular assassination. But their National Geographic has not only Earl Warren on the board of directors and works closely with NASA and von Braun, but John Connally is giving accolades to Admiral Byrd, and Byrd had come home and kept secret his relationship to what he saw down there on his military mission. That is really the answer to the future of the Falklands or the British-Argentine struggle, is how much is going on down there and what are we not being told about the area. That is the bottom line, and I can't begin to guess which way the Falkland affairs will come out, because it seems that there's a lot of hidden history that has accumulated over the past 37 years that we are not yet privy to. They're just little bits and pieces. One of the examples is a document I've referred to on this program through the years. It came out of the National Archives. David Lifton got it for me. It was a correspondence between members of the Warren Commission back in 1964. That was a long way away. It was written by David Slauson to Mr. Rankin, Lee Rankin, of the Warren Commission. And it had to do with sending the Zeiger family, their daughters, to Argentine. Argentine is where they came from, and their daddy ran the Minsk radio factory where Lee Harvey Oswald met Marina Oswald. The Zeigers introduced the two of them. And the CIA wanted to send them down to Argentine while the Warren Commission was doing their work. That's what I mean about Earl Warren and one of the examples of his covering up and bringing Argentine into that era that goes back to 1964. They made a note in their correspondence to the chief attorney of the Warren investigation, Mr. Rankin. It said at the end of this transcript, this was dated in 1964, and they're corresponding about investigating, they're supposed to be investigating a murder, June the 2nd, 1964, they wrote this. He said, the Zeigers are living, the Russians sent a message out and smuggled it out to the relative of the Zeigers who are living in the United States, and this message pleads for help to get their daughters out of Russia. And the theory is that the girls live in Argentine and they would like to go back and claim their Argentine citizenship and get out of Minsk, because Leah and Marina are out there now. They've made the introduction. Their daddy was at the Minsk radio factory. And Isaac Don Levine, who's worked with the CIA and the Defense Department for years, suggested, according to this memo, that the American government, such as the CIA, should contact the Argentine government and get the set the machinery in motion to bring the Zeiger daughters back to Argentina. So what is going down in Argentina that we have a participant in the murder of a president, John Kennedy, and down there in that area with Earl Warren covering up this particular murder as the chief investigator, and the CIA being suggested sending them down to Argentina. We have a lot of tentacles down there in Argentina that have never really been exposed. If we had thoroughly investigated the murder of John Kennedy, we'd have a little better picture of what was going down in Argentina. Also, the book, Were We Controlled, the important book on the Kennedy assassination, mentions the Bunge Corporation in Argentina, and I could do many programs on the links of that country and Antarctica and the South Pole to the Kennedy assassination, the interlocking people who have interests in that area. There was a news bulletin in 1975. CBS news correspondent Daniel Shore said he located a former CIA official who read a CIA memo about Lee Harvey Oswald. Shore interviewed the former agency employee on CBS Evening News. The former official stated he came across a memo in 1962, that's the year before Kennedy was murdered, which consisted of an interview report from a redefector from the Soviet Union. According to that official, the redefector described an ex-Marine who defected over to Russia, that was Oswald, who worked in a radio factory in Minsk and then came back to the United States with his wife in 1962. That was the exact account of Oswald's defection history. They said on CBS that the CIA memo dealt mainly with intelligence on the Minsk radio plant. And that, again, has to do with the manager of that and his family being brought back to Argentina by the CIA. CIA Director John McCone testified that the agency never had any contact at all with Oswald, but this memo suggests that they did through a Navy officer who also defected, and the Argentine connections are many. This is just one example of, and the Bunge Corporation down there, of that country to our CIA. And I've mentioned when this conflict first came up, how important it is to know that Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger and Ronald Reagan are more pro-Argentine than they are British. And no matter what they say to Margaret Thatcher or what they say on the surface, their real appeal is to get England out of the area so that they can continue whatever it is they're doing. And we're not really sure how deep or how insidious this is going to go, but they've been involved in something very dangerous for a long, long time. The Liberty Lobby, many of you know what that is. That's put out by Willie Cardo. He has an article, Falklands Are Valuable Real Estate. You better believe they are. And he's got a picture of Navy vessels and the Malvina Islands. He calls it the Malvina Islands and believes that it should go back to Argentina. This is a very particularly right-wing group who have been pro-Nazi on many, many points through the years, and they would like the Malvinas to belong to Argentina. They want the American CIA and the British out and to give that land down there, and that is very dangerous. There was an article this past week, it was in the newspaper, titled, Whoever Controls the Island Controls Sea Access to the Indian Ocean via the Cape of Good Hope. This was in the San Francisco Examiner last week. The Malvinas, strategic value to Argentine. Well, it's strategic to Argentine, and it's strategic to the United States and all countries that would like access to the Indian Ocean, the South Pacific, the North Atlantic. Whoever controls the Malvinas, this article says, controls sea access to the Indian Ocean via the Cape of Good Hope, to the South Pacific via the Drake Passage, and even the North Atlantic. This is a very strategic area, and it is referred to by Associated Press as the Malvinas, not the Falklands. And there's a lot of pressure to give this power to the Argentine government, whoever they are. The pressure is to relinquish it and take it out of British hands without defining who they are down there, who are really running this, how many of them have unlimited money and power since World War II, and with no full description of what they really are capable of doing down there. It's a very dangerous place to play around because the oceans and free world may really be decided down in this little area. It's not a matter of 1,800 people or 2,000 sheep. There's something bigger that's been brewing for 30, 40 years down there, and I think it has to come to a head. We'll take a 1-minute break and get back to some of the importance on the island in another minute.